Federal civil rights legislation passed in the 1960s. State and local laws to further spell out fair treatment across the board have passed in the years since. But there are still incidents of people not following the law when it comes to renting housing, which is why there is a Fair Housing Council of Oregon. It works to make sure people are treated fairly under the law. And council workers travel the state spreading the word about what is and is not legal. Two of the people who do that are here in the studio with me. Diane Hess is the Education Director at the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. Diane, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And Louise Dix is an education and outreach specialist with the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, based in Southern Oregon. Louise, welcome to the exchange.
Glad to be here.
Good to have you both. Let's start with the basic, simple stuff. I mean, fair housing laws seems like they've been in the book for a long time, Diane, haven't they?
They have. And as you mentioned, the 1960s, 1968 and 1988 were major federal laws, you know, dealing with fair housing, and things certainly have changed for the most part from the olden days where there might be a sign in the window that said no Jews, no blacks, or realtors not showing people homes in certain areas. But one in every 10 acts of illegal discrimination actually goes unreported today. So we get 4,000 calls a year on our discrimination hotline, and that is really the tip of the iceberg. And so why is that? A number of reasons. One is that discrimination can be much more subtle nowadays. So it might be, for example, someone looking for a rental, a manager saying very nicely, oh, I'm sorry that unit's rented, when in fact that's not the case. Also, discrimination occurs not only in rentals, but in mortgage lending. So, and homeowners insurance, and those can be very complicated processes for people to have any idea whether discrimination is occurring. So it's really important that people know their rights and that housing providers, and that's not only landlords, but also condo homeowner associations, there's a lot of issues there, know their legal responsibilities under the law.
What is a fairly typical response? I mean, if it is as subtle as you say, it seems like there are circumstances in which the person who is potentially being discriminated against may think, well, did I really hear that right? Or just decide, well, if I'm not wanted, I'll just move on. Is that often the case?
Yes, it is. Do you want to say anything
about
this one? You know, and a lot of times people are just trying to get a place to live. But and so that's why we miss a lot of them. But sometimes people do have a sense something is fishy. So, for example, somebody talks to the property manager on the phone. We have three units available. Come on down. Person shows up an hour. Let's say it's a white woman with an African-American boyfriend or a woman wearing a headscarf or someone with a disability that has an assistance animal. And they're then told the unit isn't available. Or, you know, or they tell them a amount of rent that seems higher than they remembered. They might call us and say, I'm not sure. I think this might be discrimination. And a lot of folks aren't looking for a place to live. More than half of the folks we hear from on our hotline are people already living in an apartment complex, and they're being treated unfairly. They're being treated differently from their neighbors, or they're being harassed.
What kind of different treatments, then, do you hear about, Louise Dix?
Well, there's been one down here that we're looking at right now that has to do with a woman that has a disabled child and has had a parking place to – it was a mobility challenge, and so there was a parking place near her unit, and other residents were parking in that parking place. And normally the management's supposed to assure that she gets – that place is open for her. It wasn't happening, and I guess – so she's – concerned now that it, you know, she feels like she's being discriminated against because of her daughter, and she was recently given a 30-day eviction notice or something to move out because they don't want to hassle with it anymore. So we're looking into that one. There's things like that that happen all the time.
And there's also just how the rules are enforced if people violate the rental agreement, who gets dinged and who doesn't.
So it seems like, and I have to admit that I do own rental property myself, mm-hmm. and so I have to I deal with some of the issues that landlords just deal with. But there are times when it's like, well, okay, I'll give you a little break here. But the point is that everything has to be applied the same to all the renters, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah, and yes, and that's a really good point because sometimes you may treat people differently for all kinds of reasons that has nothing to do with discrimination, but you can't control how people are perceiving things. So if you decide to, you know, you have a friend who goes to your church, perhaps, in one unit, and they want you to do some extra special work for them, and you do it for them, and you don't offer it to everybody else. Whatever your reason, you don't want to be in the position of responding to a complaint that comes through the Bureau of Labor and Industry. So you want to make sure you treat everyone consistently, unless you have a policy saying when you might make an exception.
We're talking to Louise Dix and Diane Hess at the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about how fair housing laws are implemented and how the Fair Housing Council helps people. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Louise, are people like yourself based in all corners of the state of Oregon, or responsible for all 36 counties anyway?
No, we're trying to get to that place. I'm really the first one that's been outhoused down in this area, and I cover seven.
You
might
want to change that.
I don't know. outsourced.
Okay.
She's in a very nice office, not in an outhouse.
Really not. No, I work out of the access office, which is wonderful. So, but I cover seven counties: Klamath, Coos, Curry, Lake, Douglas, Josephine, and Jackson. So it's quite a lot of miles to travel. So.
Is there a particular reason why Southern Oregon is a place where there is a Fair Housing Council rep in the region?
I guess partially because it's the farthest away from Portland, and which it was where everyone else is mm-hmm. stationed. So, yeah.
And placing you at Access seems like a logical move, because Access is an agency involved with so many things of relief to people looking for places to live and looking for food and looking for relief services.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, fair housing is not just an income-related thing. It happens to everyone at all income levels, so...
Really? And so what would be some of the examples of housing discrimination taking place at higher income levels?
Well, let's give you an example about somebody wanting to buy a house. There was an example in Portland of an African-American couple that were closing on a house, and they went to look at the yard, and they were discussing it, and a neighbor came over with his dog, and he said, "You're not moving in here, are you?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, we're closing today." And he said, "Well, you know, my dog doesn't like black people." And the guy on the other side who owns that gun shop you passed on the way in, he doesn't like black people either. Yeah, that was pretty overt. But things like, I mean, they were, you know, a middle-class African-American couple, nicer neighborhood. Yep, so it does happen.
Well, what makes this story especially interesting, though, is that the discrimination need not come from the people who are actually involved in the transaction.
This
is right?
Neighbor-on-neighbor harassment, which happens a lot. It happens in rental situations. It happens in home ownership. It happens quite a bit. We see a lot of this throughout the state,
throughout the
nation.
Are the majority of cases still generally landlord-to-tenant sorts of harassment situations?
Tenant to tenant.
Tenant to tenant, really.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, a lot of times people don't realize that falls under the law, and mm-hmm. they don't think there's anything they can do if not just their landlord or manager, but their neighbor is, you know, calling them all kinds of names or harassing them. But actually, the landlord or the homeowners association has a legal responsibility to mm-hmm. end that. And when you asked earlier about upper incomes, we have had quite a few issues happening with homeowner associations where the board members really don't understand about fair housing, especially if they haven't hired a professional management company, and upscale retirement communities mm-hmm. and assisted living communities. So all of these types of housing, really all types of housing, fall under the law.
Well, Louise Dix, it sounds like then there's a constant tracking process of trying to figure out what is discrimination under the law. Because it seems like it comes out in new guises all the time. I mean, a lot of these senior facilities didn't exist that many years ago.
Right,
but,
right.
And here we are.
And a lot of that ends up being maybe assistance animals. Someone comes in with a companion animal, and it's a no-pets retirement center, and people get very upset. And then they say, well, why does she get an animal and we don't? And so those, you know, it's different, comes up in different ways, shows up in different ways.
That one in particular could be an interesting one. Who gets an assistance animal and who doesn't? What determines that?
Well, the disability. Fair Housing Act is very broad and comprehensive, unlike the public, the ADA, the Americans with Disability Act, which covers public facilities. That's really specific as to service animals and primarily just dogs. But fair housing is very comprehensive. It can be any kind of animal. It can be companion therapy for emotional disabilities. They have to have a disability, and the animal has to serve that disability in some way to help have that person enjoy their unit, be able to enjoy their unit. So a therapy animal could be there for depression or PTSD, something like that.
But is it just the kind of thing where you go to your MD and you say, hey, can you write me a, really, that simple?
Yep. It's kind of, we say, it gets complicated because a lot of people don't get wondered about it because, you want to say.
Well, the way it should work is the doctor, as part of their course of treatment, prescribes, do you have, PTSD, you think you would benefit from bonding with an animal? Hopefully it's not just someone saying, hey, could you write me a letter? But
we
realize
that
happens.
We think that happens
a
lot.
We do think it's important, if there are medical and therapeutic professionals listening to this program, you really shouldn't do that unless the person has a disability as defined by the Fair Housing Act and you've determined it is necessary, But we also tell the landlords if they think, well, he doesn't seem depressed to me, to let that go. That's between them and their therapist or their doctor.
Right. You can't, as landlord, then act like the person who's in a therapeutic situation. You can't make that determination yourself. The Fair Housing Act, is it one of these ones that runs to several volumes on a shelf full of books?
Not the act itself, but there's all of these HUD memos and Department of Justice memos and
rules and
additional rulings. Mm-hmm. Just in the last year, HUD's had like about three new rulings that further expanded or clarified things. So altogether, yes, you're right. And then if you throw in all the different court cases that have made aspects of the law that were not clear, it ends up being another row of files. So that's another thing for any housing provider to be aware of, is nobody wants to be a case that helps clarify the law. So
you don't want yours to be a precedent.
Right. You don't want to be famous on on the bookcase.
Yeah, right. Fair housing is constantly evolving. It's very, very shades of gray, not black and white, and there's court cases coming up all the time to try to clarify things like assistance animal pieces.
We are talking to the folks at the Fair Housing Council in Oregon, Fair Housing Council of Oregon, about fair housing in Oregon. You can join this discussion on the exchange about the application of fair housing law. Join us with Diane Hess and Louise Dix at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Louise, the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, as I understand it, has only been around since like 1990. Is that right?
About 1990. Yeah. So.
Seems a little late to the game, given the fact that the laws were passed that we were talking about, 67, 68, Diane Hess.
Yeah, you can.
Well, it really wasn't until 1988 that the laws had any meat in them and there was any, first of all, funding for groups like ours and attorney fees and the ability to do testing, send out secret shoppers. So from 68 to 88, the laws existed, but there wasn't much in the way of enforcement. So then organizations like ours around the country, and that includes, for your California listeners, many organizations in Northern and Southern California, that didn't happen till after 1988, that there was funding available to establish nonprofits like us.
So is there a federal funding stream that continues to come to the Fair Housing Council of Oregon?
Hopefully.
Yeah, yeah,
we have
housing and urban development.
Yeah,
so,
it is through HUD, Fair Housing, but we do have to apply for that funding every year. It's not guaranteed, but that does represent our core funding.
All right. It seems like a couple of visits ago when we had Diane Hess here, we were talking about taking secret shoppers, I think was the term you just used, Diane, around. So, Louise, tell me about that process then of taking people around to inquire about housing and how those people get involved in the process and what happens.
They're called testers. And anyone really can be a tester unless they're a housing provider, and then we really don't think that they should be a tester because it might be conflict of interest. So it's kind of like acting. They get to play different roles, and they're given a scenario. They're given an income level and so on. And if we have a complaint about a certain apartment complex, they may send in different groups of people to test it out to see, the testers don't know what they're testing for. So they're just told, go in and ask these questions and then write it up. Let us know how you were treated. And then it's analyzed by us and we figure out if it looks like there's a pattern of discrimination happening. So I think it's very interesting. We do it not just in rental situations. We're doing it in mortgage lending and in real estate, trying to buy houses and seeing how people are treated. So
Louise Dix and Diane Hess from the Fair Housing Council of Oregon are guests on The Exchange. Our numbers here, 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, email jx@jeffnet.org. So will you send testers of different ethnic backgrounds to the same location?
Yeah.
That's the way it works.
If it looks like it's based on race or color or national origin, we would, yeah. If it looks like the discrimination is based on those protected classes.
And how often do you find situations that the testers, where there's a question of whether they're being treated fairly? I mean, is it maybe a majority of the times there's no particular issue, or a majority of times there are?
You know, it depends. I mean, there can be differential treatment for a number of reasons. You know, maybe the manager's just got an upsetting call from a spouse, and so the next person isn't really dealt with very well. So a lot of times we'll send out a second set of testers. In terms of, you know, what percentage is there evidence? There's a lot where it's differential treatment. The question is whether it's based on protected class. So after several tests, we might then discern, well, they're being treated differently because of their race. And I don't know an exact percentage to give you for that, but that becomes important evidence in case there is a case that someone wants to pursue. And I just want to add for our listeners, if anyone's listening and says, gee, this sounds like a way I could work for social justice, I'm interested in potentially becoming a tester. And as Louise said, we can't use housing providers, but if there are others who might be interested, you know, it's not a job, it's an occasional call to see if you're available. We do pay. If you're interested in attending a training to learn more about testing, if it's something that interests you, I'd like to give our number out. So you could call 1-800-424-3247.
800-424-3247. We'll make sure we put that up on Facebook once the program's over today.
But that is, again, that didn't become legal to do until 1988 and has made a huge difference because, you know, with discrimination, it's one person's word against another a lot of the times. How do you know what really happened? That testing is a very important tool for us.
Mm-hmm. And I will be doing a tester training down here in January, first of the year, probably the second week, and I'll get more information out on that through the media.
How big is your roster of testers at any time?
Do we have about 60 or something now? Yeah, I think we have about 60. Most of them are in the Portland area, so we're really trying to broaden our base out here, down here and over in Central Oregon and Eastern Oregon. So.
All right, but seven counties you serve, and I can't imagine you have that many testers spread across those seven.
No, not at this point. But we could use Portland ones, because a lot of them are phone calls.
Mm-hmm. So okay, just phone calls. Okay.
There's a lot of linguistic profiling going on.
Where people sound a certain way, there'll be an assumption about, you know.
Yeah, so we can use phone calls for that, and we can test for things like that.
For example, someone might have an accent and call three times and not get a call back. Somebody who doesn't have an accent gets a call back right away, or they're told different information about vacancies or rent or deposits based on that accent. And that can all be done over the phone. Mm-hmm. The tester can be at home in their bathrobe with their notes in front of them.
So, but the concerns of a potential landlord or a potential seller or a potential mortgager all need to be based upon numbers. Is that right? I mean, income levels and how many hours a week the person works. It's really got to get right down to that, doesn't it, Louise?
Well, yeah. They have to look at the credit history of that person, and they can legitimately turn someone down if their income isn't sufficient but they can't look at source of income. That's an issue, and that's changing come July. Used to see in the paper, no Section 8. Well, come July of next year, that will no longer be seen, because that will be illegal to discriminate against someone if they are providing Section 8 as a source of income.
And these are housing subsidies we're talking about.
Right.
Okay.
So basically, they need consistent objective criteria. They can decide what that is, where they draw the line, if they do, you know, on income or criminal history or credit history,
rental history. They can look at all of
that. It's up to them. Yeah. It's up to the landlord, but they should make sure it's consistent, and they should have it written down somewhere that they check the same thing for everyone.
And if they make an exception, they need to write that down. If there's an exception to their regular protocol, they need to make sure it's clear why they made that exception and put that down in writing.
And I think it was somebody from the Fair Housing Council I asked this question of before, but it really can't get to something like, gee, I just got a bad feeling about these people. I mean, side by side, you got two people objectively. You take the first one or what?
Chronological.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people don't do that. They take the one they feel better about. So, yeah, but it should be chronological. And like I said, if there's an exception, they need to document that and explain why the exception was made. So.
And even better, have a policy in advance saying, even better, have a policy, I'm sorry, a policy in advance saying when they will make exceptions. Mm. So they're not doing it just to respond to somebody they like.
All right. So if a tester finds a situation, if there's a cause for complaint, is this a civil process? Is this a criminal process? And what are the potential penalties?
Go ahead.
Civil. And first, I should say a lot of the folks who call us don't necessarily go into an official complaint process. A lot of times our staff, a lot of landlords don't even know, will try to advocate and just work it out quickly. Mm-hmm. But it is a civil process. Most of the complaints are dealt through an administrative process through the Oregon Civil Rights Division, BOLA, Bureau of Oregon Labor and Industries, and they will do an investigation that might involve sending out testers or talking to witnesses. They would require the landlord to give their records for them to review. And they will try to conciliate. If that doesn't work, it goes to an administrative law judge. Some of the cases also go to federal court. I mean, there could be the Department of Justice, any number of players. So as far as damages go, it could go anywhere from, you know, they have to put up a poster and go to a training and give someone a month's rent to, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Really? Okay, so it could get pretty steep.
It's all over, yeah.
So what is the most single most common complaint, then? What's the most often reason that people are going to seek out the services of the Fair Housing Council?
Well, almost 50% of our calls are related to disability, and a lot of them now are unreasonable accommodations. I'd say that's probably the biggest is reasonable accommodations, primarily in the form of assistance animals, could be live-in caregivers, those kinds of things.
All right. Louise Dix and Diane Hess are with the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. Louise is an education and outreach specialist based in Southern Oregon. Diane Hess is the education director based in Portland. All right, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Good to have you both here. That'll do it for this hour. Hour number two, we'll talk to George C. Dawn, the author of The Shining Sea, coming up on the Jefferson Exchange.